All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of, you guessed it, the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Bryce Paul, but I am unfortunately not joined by my notorious companion, my best friend, Mr. Aaron Pizza Mind Malone. He is off in some unnamed country, some faraway land traveling. God knows where he is, but Pizza Mind, if you're out there and you hear me, I miss you, buddy. But today I have the distinct privilege, the distinct honor of interviewing our latest guest here on the Crypto 101 podcast, a DeFi expert, a guy who lives and breathes crypto, an OG, if you will, Neil Zumwalt, who is the co-founder of Credmark. So Neil, welcome to the show.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet, man. Before we even kick things off here with your background, or with Credmark, I see you're wearing an Olympus hat. what does that mean? Tickle me pink here.
Olympus? Oh, you haven't heard of Olympus, Bryce. Olympus is a project in the DeFi 2.0 space that is offering excellent, excellent APRs, and they use that to secure a treasury along with their bond products in order to essentially create the first decentralized reserve currency. And yeah, they are doing a pretty good job of it, if I do say so myself. They've got the marketing machine, they've got the brains behind it. They seems to be a great project.
So, yeah, well, one of the analysts that we had just hired, a guy by the name of Matt, Matt said that, you know, I told him, I was like, hey, like, go research Ohm. I'm hearing lots of buzz about it. Tell me what's good. And he came back, he goes, Bryce, I didn't sleep. And it was the first time since I, basically, he goes, the last time I like went through this sort of fervor was when I went through Polkadot. He goes, I couldn't sleep. I was infatuated, and you know, my whole mind was blown. He goes, and that hasn't happened in like 2 years. He goes, I went through the rabbit hole on Ohm, and he goes, I'm totally red pilled. I think this is cool. So, you know, obviously not investment advice. I actually don't own any Ohm, but you know, some of my affiliates might. Who knows? But regardless, Ohm is a pretty interesting project. But I just saw your hat, so I had to comment on it.
I get lots of compliments on this hat. That's for
yeah.
Sure.
It's pretty cool. Okay, well, regardless, Olympus DAO. Now let's move on, Neil. Who the heck are you, right? Give us a quick background, a quick 101 on Neil Zumwalt.
Well, I am an engineer turned founder coming into the crypto space. All of my previous work was in green energy and industrial automation, actually. So when I came into the crypto space in 2018, I immediately started digging deeper, deeper, deeper into the data side of things. So data and doing analysis of how the logic works and finding all the places where this could fail. That had been my job previously for nearly a decade. And so I just started applying those skills to the crypto space and looking at these sort of automated systems that you can never change. They're totally immutable bits of logic here and there. It sounded not only terrifying, but also super exciting. So the first one I dug into was MakerDAO. And, you know, at the time they had like $100,000 collateralized and they were doing the single-sided DAI. And I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. So I started digging into that. And Credmark was born over the next, you know, 3 years, really, of me doing my own research, me looking at how do we measure credit risk, you know, because that seemed like the big place where you've got these over-collateralized loans. And as they become under-collateralized, what happens? So I was digging into that for a long time and realized as the space became more and more complex and more of these protocols started emerging that that you can't necessarily do apples to apples from TradFi, but you can use a lot of the existing knowledge and wisdom from that space to really dive into what are the smart things to do in the DeFi world. Because, you know, there's a million ways that things become insolvent, but what is the average person who's just going to a website going to think about those things? So that's how Credmark was born. And then earlier this year, we really started taking off, and now we've released some product, and It's more than just me doing my own research for my own edification. So
nice. Well, it sounds like it has evolved just insofar as DeFi has really evolved, really. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw different iterations of it. And now, you know, it's always, you know, the industry is not so clever enough to call it like DeFi and then DeFi 2.0. Like, that's not that clever, but there is this new step, right? And I wish they would have called it something else. But here we are discussing DeFi 2.0. So, Neil, what are the market differences? I mean, you've seen DeFi, like you said, from the inception, right? I like to call MakerDAO the grandfather of DeFi. Mm-hmm. 1.0, like you said, it really did kick off this whole sort of like borrow lend facility that can be done on chain. But yeah, catch us up. What's DeFi 1.0 and where are we at now with DeFi 2.0?
So DeFi 1.0 is really the DeFi that most of the current blue chips I would define as DeFi 1.0. And those are mostly based on like synthetic assets. They're mostly based on borrowing and lending, like collateralization, securing crypto instruments with other crypto. And really like there's not, and really leaning into kind of that trustless side of things where you need to have more in your reserves than you do otherwise, because you can't trust anyone else on chain. DeFi 2.0, I think, is a little bit more in the optimistic realm where you've got things like Ohm that are saying that some of the value that they're generating is sort of ineffable on top of the existing sort of the existing like assets under management that you may have by some of these protocols. But I will say that the DeFi 2.0 space is actually not that well defined. So there's a bunch of things. There's a bunch of different protocols where I'm like, I wouldn't have thought of that as DeFi 2.0, but people are calling it DeFi 2.0 kind of if it came out this year, it seems like. Mm. But generally, yes, it's DeFi that was born in the bull market. So it has this kind of market optimism about it. That is, these interest rates can keep going and they are, you know, locked tokens will stay locked and unlocked tokens will stay unlocked. And they're not necessarily wrong, but it's certainly less about managing the risk than DeFi 1.0 was. Mm. So by and large, my research is on the DeFi 1.0 space because it is more about solvency than the DeFi 2.0 space is in general.
Yeah, fascinating. Really fascinating. So let's kind of stick on the 1.0 era and talk about basically, in your opinion, the big why, right? Like, why does the DeFi industry really need these sort of risk metrics that Credmark is generating?
Yeah. Well, I think that the reason why is because crypto wants to grow and because the people who have been in crypto from its inception, those are the really risk tolerant users in general. So if you got into crypto early, it means that you have a huge appetite for what's new and what the shiny thing in crypto is. But that doesn't necessarily describe most people or most institutions that we're going to need buy-in from almost everybody in order to really redefine the financial system. And so you need to have like a different approach than sort of the optimism I was just talking about in order to really get buy-in from this next kind of class of in both the retail investors and the institutional investors who might be more risk averse, but who want to participate and have something to add to the ecosystem.
What are kind of the main risks? I mean, I know we've talked about, you know, under collateralization and kind of like insolvency and bank runs and stuff. What are some of the other things that you kind of look at in the DeFi ecosystem and say, yeah, that's a risk. That's something we want to monitor. That's something that, you know, lenders will care about and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So we break it up into three main categories that we're really interested in specifically. And that is, the market risk. So that's just the price of the underlying assets. They go up, they go down. We've seen it.
And the more volatility this sort of thing has, the higher the risk score, you would say?
In general, yes. And so we measure that with something called value at risk, which is we look back at the last 365 days, break it into 10-day chunks, and then say, what was the worst 10-day chunk of the past year? And we say that, then we say, what's the worst 1% chance of that thing happening again? And that's our value at risk. So with our value at risk score, what we're hoping to measure the market risk by saying, this happens 1% of every 10-day chunk. So you need to be prepared for it. You know, it's not like this doesn't ever happen. So we need to look at what sort of the downstream effects are when we get these 1% days. And we've seen, you know, we've seen plenty of them.
It seems like the 1% days are just freaking normal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, supposedly they happen 3.6 times a year, but you know, that's our measure for market risk. And then we're also looking at liquidity risk, which is a little more specific in the crypto space than it is in the traditional space. And what liquidity risk means is, if I have some token, can I convert it into the token I want to convert it into? And that can be a number of different things. It could either mean that the liquidity doesn't exist on the market. It can mean that the liquidity doesn't exist in the pools, or it can mean that you don't have the reserves in some DeFi protocol in order to actually convert your wrapped, you know, USDC back into USDC so you can spend it. So that's what we call liquidity risk. And there's in the DeFi space, there's a bunch of different ways that you can become essentially illiquid.
Rug pulled.
Rug pull is a big one, right? Where it's like, oh, I pulled the reserves out of a pool and you're stuck with the wrapped version of those reserves, or some sort of stake in the pool that is now essentially useless. And it's not that the price went down. It's just that you can't convert it back into what is a more useful asset. Then the third type of risks that we're looking at are what we're calling operational risk. And that's where it gets really interesting in crypto, because that's where you find things like exploits, where you've got flash loan exploits, or you've got reentrancy exploits, and all the stuff that the auditors are looking for, but can't necessarily find. So those are some of the more interesting sort of crypto native risks that we're looking at. And in order to figure stuff like that out, we say, hey, can somebody manipulate the price of this asset? What would it take? And so when we're looking at it, we're saying, how distributed are the oracles? We just saw, like, a few days ago, Coinbase told me I had $2.5 billion in my
right. The coin market cap API got bonked, huh?
Exactly. So imagine if I had taken out a huge loan against those assets in that moment, and that was the only oracle you were using. So that, it may seem, you know, it's funny, but it can have like real downstream consequences if you haven't really verified all the data that is on your input. So we kind of take a look at those verification mechanisms, and we take a look at some of your like very typical, when I have some asset, is it, are the, all the other assets on a protocol sort of beholden to the risk of that one thing? And so that's what happened in the Cream hack, where YUSDC, the price of that got hacked, and every other asset on Cream Finance was essentially exposed to the risk of that one asset being hacked. And so, you know, that's maybe getting into the weeds a little bit, but I hope that is, it shows that there's like a bunch of new types of risks in crypto that are not only terrifying, but really exciting. And
yeah, and actually it was funny, the gentleman who I recorded an interview with earlier this morning, right before this, a guy by the name of Adam Back. And Adam was talking to me about how there had been $7.7 billion of money that was basically lost on Ethereum, or hacked to a sense, through whether it was a rug pull or through one of these associated risks that you were just talking about. And so to quantify, right, you're like, oh, wow, like, you know, somebody who might be listening at home thinking, oh, like, that's just a small subsec, you know, there's not that much at risk. Well, $7.7 billion just in 2021 that was affected, you know, through like he said, like Neil said, through just these different exploits, like on the Cream Finance hack, or, you know, some of these different that's a lot of money that's at risk. And so it's a big market that you're really addressing here, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too, because most of the time when, you know, when one of the media outlets is reporting, when they were reporting about the Cream Finance hack, they were saying that it was something like $100 million got hacked, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but Cream had like 17 billion TVL, but suddenly there wasn't enough liquidity in the reserves for anyone to pull out that value that was already locked. So that the downstream effect of $100 million is that, you know, it was 170 times as much money that had suddenly become illiquid because of this small hack. So when people talk about the hacks, I don't think they're necessarily capturing how much of an effect that can have downstream.
Yeah, totally.
And that's, yeah, sorry.
Oh, no. I was just saying, it's just there's so much to be monitoring in, you know, Ethereum and of course Solana and Luna, and there's just so many, you know, Bitcoin, there's so many different platforms here. It's just, you know, how do you as a founder, like, you know, bite off your part of the industry? You know, what, you know, I guess, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. It's finding market fit is always like a big challenge, especially when you have such a fragmented industry. And I think that's what you're getting at, is that like the fragmentation of this means that you can't have expertise in everything. And when we're establishing ourselves and our set of expertise, we're really looking for one of the nice features about being an analytics firm with risk is that risk takes a lot of history in order to monitor, right? So it actually is interesting that it kind of slows down the analysis that we can do, and we're sort of a follow feature rather than like a leading feature of these DeFi platforms. So where other DeFi protocols are sort of like trying to find their spot on one of the newer chains that may not be fully featured, and they can, you know, find market fit with by applying that feature to a new L1 or a new L2, we can sort of watch the growth of each of these different token ecosystems and say, well, where's the DeFi happening? Where are the biggest, where can we have the biggest impact? And luckily that information is pretty readily available for us. And so right now we're only monitoring the ETH chain, and we're looking at the L2s and kind of waiting for just enough DeFi to be happening on the L2s that we can get some history on it. But largely most of those launched this year. So there's not a whole lot you can do before you have a year's worth of data. So we're looking at the ETH data, and we think that many of these L2s will follow kind of the same evolution that was available on ETH, but it might be a little accelerated because there's more people who know about DeFi now and who are users. So we expect it to be faster than the ETH evolution of DeFi, but largely mirror it.
Wow. Fascinating. And so is the vision for Credmark almost like in the same way that, you know, Twitter has a blue check mark next to a person. They're like, all right, you're verified. Is the cred mark just like, hey, this, you know, your address, you know, 0x123456789, you've got an 800 cred mark. And so, you know, you're going to get a lower rate. And then, you know, this guy 0x866, you know, he's got a 200 cred mark. So he's, you know, he's getting a 16% rate.
So that's where our research definitely started. We have since kind of moved away from that because we think that there's actually more that we can do. We can have a bigger impact if we are exposing sort of like the underlying factors to the DeFi platforms themselves and to the money managers, where we can say, as the DeFi Lego stack starts to build up, these top level DeFi protocols that are built on top of this foundational piece, they need to know as much as they can about the foundational piece in order to keep the tower from falling over, essentially. And so that's really been how we've shifted our focus to a more analytical, more quantitative output for what we're doing, rather than like the check mark type thing.
So after peaking at $68,000 in mid-November, Bitcoin has dropped by roughly 40%. So no one said flying the DeFi flag was going to be easy. But what if I told you that your portfolio might be overweight in Bitcoin? In fact, you might also want to consider diversifying into other alternative assets, perhaps like blue chip art. In some cases, actually, paintings have seen appreciation similar to crypto over the long term. For instance, a Picasso painting recently sold for $103 million at an auction. And that's a 1,400% increase from its original price at auction. And now there's a new platform that lets you invest in paintings like that without needing to be a gazillionaire. And over 310,000 investors have signed up. And just the other day, they had a $7.4 million Banksy painting that sold out in under 3 hours. Now, I've partnered with this platform and got you all priority access to their newest paintings. And so all you got to do is log on to masterworks.io/crypto101. Again, that's masterworks.io/crypto101. Again, masterworks.io/crypto101. And you can check out all the good stuff they got on their platform. So I want you guys as well to see the important disclosures that are at masterworks.io/disclaimer. And we're also going to link to those in the show notes. You mentioned a great analogy that I kind of want you to unpack here is this idea of like DeFi as money Legos. I think a lot of our listeners at home might be like, wait, what? Legos, like those little things I buy for my kids over Christmas. What does that have to do with DeFi? But maybe you could unpack that for us.
Yeah, totally. So DeFi Legos is a concept that, you know, you have these DeFi protocols that have some sort of output that is composable. So if I am to put my USDC into Aave, for example, I'm going to get back a USDC. So Aave USDC. Now I can take that Aave USDC and I can put that into a curve vault or a curve position. And then I get back my LP tokens that represent my AUSDC that I am supplying to curve. Now I can take those tokens and then put those in a Yearn vault to get a APY on it. And then the Yearn vault, you know, kind of reinvests the curve tokens that I'm getting as rewards back into the whole thing. And so we like to use that as our example of what a DeFi Lego stack would be, where there you've got Yearn on top, curve in the middle, Aave, and then underneath is USDC. So when you are investing in a Yearn vault, you're inheriting the risks of everything that's below you on the Lego stack, and they just stack up nicely, just, you know, visually how a Lego would work, where you really can't put that second piece on unless that first piece is firmly in place. And so we part of the analysis that we do is to say, how do these risks affect each other as you build these Lego, as you get higher and higher up the stack? So your risk gets higher because you're inheriting more and more risk from below. But the rewards also get higher because, you know, there's more benefit to having these kinds of assets locked up for longer periods of time. And we call that stickiness. So
is it safe to say that you would call yourselves like white hat hackers, where like you basically are like, you know, you have all this data and then boom, your system kind of gives you an alert. And would you then go to like, you know, Cream Finance before the hack and be like, hey, we found this risk, like you should address it? or is it more of like a retrospective sort of, you know, is the system supposed to be preventative or retrospective, I guess?
It is supposed to be. So this gets into a really big question that we have internally. I don't think I would call us white hat hackers because we're trying to get the data layer really well set up. But I do think that it's really interesting, this debate that we've had internally between, basically there's three things that you need in order to manage your risk. You need data, you need analysis, and then thirdly, you need the tooling to do to act on it, right? And we've decided that we can't quite tackle all three because we're a startup. You know, you have to kind of pick what you're good at. So in that respect, we haven't really gotten to the tooling section because we think that there's a lot to be pulled from the data and the analysis side of things. And so we have actually taken the strategy of partnering with people who are building the tooling, and then we can inform them as to what the kind of underlying state of risk is underneath that tooling. So we've been working with a company called CoinShift that is sort of building DAO treasury tools. So these DAOs have raised a bunch of money and they've got these huge treasuries and they need to know where to put that in order to get some return on it, but they don't want to put their entire treasury at risk. So they need to kind of know, okay, if I'm going to invest in this or if I'm going to lock up my treasury in this DeFi protocol, sort of what are the ways that can fail? And do I have the data that I need to get an early warning?
Fascinating. And you know, I think this is a big part of DeFi 2.0 is like this protocol controlled value, or, you know, protocol owned liquidity. They're kind of calling it a few different things, but I love this concept of, you know, all these just different people around the world who own the same token, right? They could come to a voting forum and they could vote on basically how the treasury is spent. You know, it's in the same way. It's like, you know, being able to vote on how our taxes are spent or how our government invests money. You know, it's happening on these small localized scales. Do you really view like kind of the future, you know, if you were to look, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out, whatever, like, do you ever like envision sort of this world where it's like predominantly little digital nation states, like, as opposed to like now all these, you know, huge, you know, 200 nations that kind of rule the world?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, yes.
Right.
I think that is the most exciting thing about the DAO structure. That is the most exciting thing about DeFi. I think that we have a little bit of expansion and then contraction to do before we really figure out the best way to do these types of things. But the experimentation around these DAO structures is fascinating. And it's been very fun to kind of dip our toes in and like sort of stake our claim, being sort of, we're sort of a Web 2.0 company, right? Because we're like, we're taking Web 3 data. And in order to do the transformations that we have to do, you have to do that on traditional cloud computing.
Totally.
For now, right? Like, and so we're looking ahead at the future and saying, where can people contribute to that structure, and without it getting into, oh, we're going to hold an asset that represents part of the treasury. We're doing like a little bit of that. We are doing protocol owned liquidity. Credmark owns all of its own liquidity. We manage all of our own liquidity positions. We manage our treasury, and we have people vote on how we manage our treasury. We're very public about it. So, but like, is it going to get to the nation state kind of level? I think that's not actually super hard. If you look at the size of some of these treasuries, yeah, they're operating as if they are a small nation. And I think that's not going to go away. Where our geographic boundaries were before, I think we're going to see our economic boundaries being entirely digital geographies,
yeah,
instead of being like sea to shining sea. You know what I mean?
Totally. No, I think especially like, you know, I've always thought like, okay, like the largest nation in the world, like that's Facebook. Like they got, you know, 2.5 billion users all around the world. And now, of course, they've changed their name to Metaverse. right? And, you know, every single metaverse token just went bonkers after that. But it really does show us like this evolution of humanity from the physical to the digital, right? Every, you know, tech company's been talking about the digital revolution since, you know, early 2000s. And it's like, it's just, you know, it's finally happening. And now it's becoming, you know, very visceral. Yeah, it's just like what you said, like, you know, digital geographies as opposed to like these physical geographies. I think that's exactly where we're headed.
Yeah. I've always thought that one of the scariest things in the world would be if Amazon started a military. You know what I mean? I was just like,
Jeff, I'm just like, if you're listening, my God. Don't get any ideas.
Yeah. Do not listen to this, Jeff.
Well, he's always listening. That's the whole thing.
I'm sure he is. Yeah. We don't get away, but like they own all the entire distribution. They have, yeah, it's terrifying. They have everything that they need to take over the whole world. And that's that the dystopian version of that is the like corporate nation state. And I think the utopian version of that is sort of this user owned nation state. I think that's going to be a huge conflict coming up. And I think that we're already seeing people. I think I'm not super up to date on the whole controversy, but I think there was something where Jack tweeted out that VC Web3 is just owned by the VCs or something.
Yeah,
along something those like lines. That. It's like something very bearish on Web3. And you know, I think that there are cases where that's true, where the VCs have an outsized control, but it's all about us finding the places where you can reward distribution rather than rewarding consolidation. And if that is going to happen, if that can happen, then we can see these kinds of like more equitable structures and potentially even the whole like DAO nation state that you can say, hey, I want my taxes, quote unquote, to go towards this piece of infrastructure, which I don't get to vote on my own roads, you know? Well, I kind of.
Yeah, I really do feel like one of the driving factors with like DAOs and why there's just such a huge uptake and like the participation numbers are just, you know, crazy. I think a lot of people just don't really feel represented by their representatives, right? You know, whether it's the people that you see in Congress or the people that are, you know, I think, you know, people do feel more represented by their local authorities probably than they do their like federal and like larger authorities. And I think that's just a function of like proximity, right? Like people trust things and operate well within, you know, sort of frameworks that are like close to them. And I think that's the one thing that's really driving a lot of like, you know, DeFi and DAOs is just because it does like localize things and like there's more power in local communities than there are, you know, broad communities. And these large overarching, you know, governments have kind of become too big to fail, if you will. But, you know, that's, you know, I don't want to call for the end of like the, you know, the countries or end of the world or anything like that would be pretty bad. Like it's probably a long tail thing, but I think that is sort of the long-term trend is like, yeah, kind of like, you know, winding down big government and doing things more locally. And it starts with the economy and, you know, crypto is, you know, decentralized local economies. But anyhow, I'm getting far too philosophical here.
I want to jump in with just a little, just to one more iota here and say that when you say proximity, you know, I think more access, right? Because I may be on the other side of the world from my DAO representative, if that becomes a thing. But in general, you have access to these people pretty easily. Mm. You know, if you're in the Discord and you're part of a contributing member of the DAO, like most people have pretty good access to the leadership at these DAOs, even though their treasuries are worth billions. Like it's kind of unprecedented. And I think it's super exciting. So
now I kind of have just switching gears. I'm kind of curious. I like asking people this. What surprises have you uncovered? You know, in your journey and you're trawling through massive troves of data, you know, what's been the most surprising discovery? Have there been any, maybe a general trend of sort of discoveries that you've found?
So I think the most interesting the most interesting thing I've learned is that even in the digital space, you do get sort of, there is still like some celebrity culture, even in the crypto space, watching that kind of emerge as it's like a new class of celebrity, but it still exists where you get these like super devs. And that has been really interesting to see that kind of reinvent itself in the DAO space. And then as far as
Andre Kronje, yep. Anatoly Yakovenko, Vitalik Buterin, Sam Bankman-Fried, like there's all these guys that are just like, you know, people fanboy over them.
Yeah, exactly. Bantag, Hayden, yep. Like all of those guys. And like, we can just list them off.
Liquidity Wizard, yeah, the Zeus. Yeah, like, I think we're just nerds.
Either it's that, or we have kind of reinvented celebrity, which, I mean, reinventing the dev celebrity is like, I guess you kind of had Bill Gates in the 80s, but like, there's not a lot of examples.
Yeah.
And so I think that's been a really surprising thing that I've seen. And then as far as like the rabbit holes that my research has taken us down, one of the most interesting things is to ask people, when I meet money managers, one of the first things that I ask them, and this could be like hedge funds, VCs, DeFi platforms, just like anyone who's like kind of managing money. You ask, what is the risk-free rate in DeFi? And it's amazing how many people consider like the DeFi, the lowest level of the DeFi Legos to be a risk-free rate. And there's sort of like an overwhelming trust in code, mm-hmm. where people think that there's literally no way that they can lose their Aave or Compound USDC, which is not technically true. But I mean, they do a good job of risk management, but it's not risk-free in the way that, you have, I mean, I guess in terms of governments, it's not technically risk-free either, but in the way that treasury bonds are sort of like backed up by the social, like a social contract that is so large that it can't be broken.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily exist in DeFi. And certainly, when you compare it to traditional finance and some of the financial tools that exist there, they're massively more risky than a bunch of traditional financial tools. That's not to say that they're not absolutely awesome, because the rewards are higher than in traditional finance, but it's not the risk-free rate. And then the other thing that people say is just growth on Bitcoin. they think that there's like a never-ending growth on Bitcoin, and that's always a surprising thing to hear from people who are managing huge sums of money.
Yeah. Wow. Trippy. And, yeah. Kind of switching gears actually to Bitcoin. I know we spent most of the time talking about Ethereum and Web3. That's where you spend most of your time. But I want to harken back to something I learned about you in the very introduction, was that you said you had a focus on green energy and renewables and sort of things like that. And there's this big discussion now around Bitcoin's, mining being quite energy intensive and all that kind of stuff. But then there's a lot of really smart Bitcoiners that are like, starting to talk about gas flaring and, being able to recapture sort of this excess gas that would typically get flared out and, hurt the environment. Whereas Bitcoiners could come in, they could take up that excess energy and they could be mining Bitcoin with it. But do you have any sort of like opinions on, Bitcoin's mining process and maybe anything around like the gas flaring stuff?
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you have any, what will be true about Bitcoin is really true of any proof of works network in terms of the energy consumed. In terms of the gas flaring, I haven't done my research on that side of things. So I don't know for sure. But one of the more interesting things about how the grid works is that you need to send energy somewhere, right? It has to be consumed at the time of generation, or else it's essentially wasted. Because our storage mechanisms are really, really, really not very sophisticated.
So this is why they're calling Bitcoin a money battery, right?
Yes. And so there's like there's this idea that that if you can generate value while there is too much energy, you can use that value when there's not enough, right? Mm-hmm. So like it's a little bit of a roundabout way to do it, but you can essentially store value during times of excess, because it has to go somewhere, or else you shouldn't be generating it. Yeah. And that's something called overvoltage on the grid, where if you have too much energy on the grid, that's a really bad thing. So people will ramp down their energy production during times when they think that the energy consumption is going to be low. And so those things are in en masse, those things are pretty predictable, but making that even more predictable by having sort of a consistent energy consumption mechanism in place that can ramp up and down more quickly than, say, a hydroelectric dam can ramp up and down could actually be a stabilizing force on the grid. Now, do I think that's a little optimistic? I do, but it just goes to show that like that if there's value there, ingenuity will follow. And I think that with the amount of value that Bitcoin has created for just technology in general, I think that, yeah, I can easily imagine the Bitcoin money space giving something back by helping make the energy grid as efficient as Bitcoin in general has been at storing value.
Wow. I love it. That was very well said, and highly encourage everybody to go rewind that and listen to that again. I know I will, but that's super interesting stuff. And, you know, it's just crazy, like, because, you know, I didn't even want to go here, but I think we should. Like, the price of energy right now is just soaring through the roof, right? I mean, obviously inflation is here, and that's kind of a function of a whole host of things, the money printing, the supply chain bottleneck and stuff. But what we're seeing actually in Europe is like an energy crisis. Mm-hmm. And what's kind of high level, you know, I don't know, you know, this was not in the outline. I didn't think we were going to go here, but high level, like what's happening like globally, like, are we in an energy crisis sort of mode? I mean, if it's kind of just in Europe, maybe it's trickling over to Asia. What's kind of going on here?
Listen, I have been out of the game now for long enough that I can't necessarily speak to it. And as far as like the most recent market movements on energy, I am not aware of what is causing that. Unfortunately, I would love to go there with you, but I just don't know enough right now.
All right. Fair enough. I tried to sneak one in on you, but regardless, Neil, I mean, this has been a fantastic conversation. What, you know, last question for you. What is a question that I didn't ask, right? That probably should have been asked.
Credmark isn't an interesting position because we are not, our protocol exists to support as a secondary product instead of the primary product of what we're building, where our protocol that we're building out is just to get access and incentivize the creation of data models, because our data analytics are all based on these risk primitives, which are data models, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As you can imagine, there's a lot of computing power and a lot of data storage that goes into that. And that's all happening off chain. And for the foreseeable future, as in the next 2 to 3 years, I don't see the technology evolving to the point where we can actually do much of that work, that computing work on chain. So we need to figure out how to make this more Web3 native. And in order to do that, what we've done is we've said, okay, we're going to use the knowledge of our community and have them come in and build models, and we can incentivize those people and sort of automate the incentives around the models. So we're using Web3 as the layer of incentivization to create something more scalable on the data side. And so the data access, the data submission, and the data validation are all actually happening off chain, but all of the accounting for that and all of the incentivization for that can happen on chain so that it's totally transparent. And we think that this is like a totally new model for anyone who's essentially selling data in order to share those revenues and to incentivize the people who are making the data accessible in the first place.
And you mentioned that you're a web, you know, you kind of said it off the cuff, but you know, kind of like a web 2.0 company working with, you know, web 3 data sets. Are there other sort of companies that you see that are kind of coming about that are like that? You know, I saw, for instance, Stripe is, you know, hired like a head of crypto, and they're going to start figuring out how they could integrate it. Do you see this as like kind of a big trend?
Yeah, I really, really do. And so I think that one of the unique things about Credmark is that we're trying something new with how we structure it. And I genuinely think that a bunch of people are going to follow when they see the stuff that we're coming out with, when they understand, oh, you can actually like manage this whole, the big complicated thing in a data company is access, right? Who has access to the data? Mm-hmm. How do you monetize that? And how do you send that where it needs to be? And how do you like collectively own the, how do you collectively own a data set? So far, I haven't seen anyone do that yet. So Dune Analytics is pretty close in the sense that they have community generated dashboards. Nansen just did a big raise, and they've sort of hinted that there's like a social element coming out, but I don't know what that is. So that could be more Web3 focused, but as of right now, I don't see a lot of the data, and even more so risk data, being used in that way.
Well, Neil, I truly, really enjoyed this conversation and learning all about Credmark and your journey here. Thanks for coming on to the Crypto 101 podcast. And I really do hope that we could have you join us again sometime in the future, whenever the next product launches or something exciting happens. Maybe there's a crazy thing that happens in the markets. We need your take on it. But, we'd love to have you back, Neil.
Sounds great. Yeah, I'll let you know if there's a... there's a hot new exploit that, you know, is on its way or whatever.
Hell yeah. All right. Well, until next time, and everybody at home listening, thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you again soon.